Chapter 13. A clock. Only once, however, was she overcome by actual drowsiness. In that moment of oblivion, her head sank gently against him. D'Urberville stopped the horse, withdrew his feet from the stirrups, turned sideways on the saddle, and enclosed her waist with his arm to support her. This immediately put her on the defensive, and with one of those sudden impulses of reprisal to which she was liable, she gave him a little push from her. In his ticklish position, he nearly lost his balance, and only just avoided rolling over into the road. The horse, though a powerful one, being fortunately the quietest he rode. "That is devilish unkind," he said. "Mean no harm, only to keep you from falling." She pondered suspiciously, till, thinking that this might after all be true, she relented, and said quite humbly, "I beg your pardon, sir. I won't pardon you, unless you show some confidence in me." "Good God!" he burst out, "what am I, to be repulsed so by a mere chit like you? For near 3 mortal months have you trifled with my feelings, eluded me, and snubbed me, and I won't stand it. I'll leave you tomorrow, sir." "No, you will not leave me tomorrow. Will you, I ask once more, show your belief in me, by letting me clasp you with my arm? Come, between us two and nobody else, now. We know each other well, and you know that I love you, and think you the prettiest girl in the world, which you are. Mayn't I treat you as a lover?" She drew a quick pettish breath of objection, writhing uneasily on her seat, looked far ahead, and murmured, "I don't know, I wish, how can I say yes, or no?" When he settled the matter, by clasping his arm round her as he desired, and Tess expressed no further negative. Thus they sidled slowly onward till it struck her they had been advancing for an unconscionable time far longer than was usually occupied by the short journey from Chaseborough, even at this walking pace, and that they were no longer on hard road, but in a mere trackway. "Why, where be we?" she exclaimed. "Passing by a wood." "A wood, what wood? Surely we are quite out of the road?" "A bit of the Chase, the oldest wood in England. It is a lovely night, and why should we not prolong our ride a little?" "How could you be so treacherous?" said Tess, between archness and real dismay, and getting rid of his arm, by pulling open his fingers one by one, though at the risk of slipping off herself. "Us, when I've been putting such trust in you, and obliging you to please you, because I thought I had wronged you by that push. Please set me down, and let me walk home." "You cannot walk home, darling, even if the air were clear. We are miles away from Trantridge, if I must tell you, and in this growing fog you might wander for hours among these trees." "Never mind that," she coaxed. "Put me down, I beg you. I don't mind where it is, only let me get down, sir, please." "Very well, then, I will on one condition. Having brought you here to this out-of-the-way place, I feel myself responsible for your safe conduct home, whatever you may yourself feel about it. As to your getting to Trantridge without assistance, it is quite impossible, for, to tell the truth, dear, owing to this fog, which so disguises everything, I don't quite know where we are myself. Now, if you will promise to wait beside the horse, while I walk through the bushes till I come to some road or house, and ascertain exactly our whereabouts, I'll deposit you here willingly. When I come back I'll give you full directions, and if you insist upon walking you may, or you may ride at your pleasure." She accepted these terms, and slid off on the near side, though not till he had stolen a cursory kiss. He sprang down on the other side. "I suppose I must hold the horse?" said she. "Oh no, it's not necessary," replied Alec, patting the panting creature. "He's had enough of it for tonight." He turned the horse's head into the bushes, hitched him onto a bough, and made a sort of couch or nest for her in the deep mass of dead leaves. "Now, you sit there," he said. "The leaves have not got damp as yet. Just give an eye to the horse, it will be quite sufficient." He took a few steps away from her, but, returning, said, "By the by, Tess, your father has a new cob today. Somebody gave it to him." "Somebody? You?" D'Urberville nodded. "Oh, how very good of you that is," she exclaimed, with a painful sense of the awkwardness of having to thank him just then. "And the children have some toys. I didn't know you ever sent them anything," she murmured, much moved. "Almost wish you had not." "Yes, I almost with it. Why, dear? It hampers me so. Tessie, don't you love me ever so little now?" "I'm grateful," she reluctantly admitted. "But I fear I do not." The sudden vision of his passion for herself as a factor in this result so distressed her that, beginning with one slow tear, and then following with another, she wept outright. "Don't cry, dear, dear one. Now sit down here, and wait till I come." She passively sat down amid the leaves he had heaped, and shivered slightly. "Are you cold?" he asked. "Not very, a little." He touched her with his fingers, which sank into her as into down. "Why, you have only that puffy muslin dress on, how's that? It's my best summer one. 'Twas very warm when I started, and I didn't know I was going to ride, and that it would be night. Nights grow chilly in September. Let me see." He pulled off a light overcoat that he had worn, and put it round her tenderly. "Tea, that's it, now you'll feel warmer," he continued. "Ow, my pretty, rest there, I shall soon be back again." Having buttoned the overcoat round her shoulders, he plunged into the webs of vapor which by this time formed veils between the trees. She could hear the rustling of the branches as he ascended the adjoining slope, till his movements were no louder than the hopping of a bird, and finally died away. With the setting of the moon the pale light lessened, and Tess became invisible as she fell into reverie upon the leaves, where he had left her. In the meantime Alec D'Urberville had pushed on up the slope, to clear his genuine doubt as to the quarter of the chase they were in. He had, in fact, ridden quite at random for over an hour, taking any turning that came to hand in order to prolong companionship with her, and giving far more attention to Tessa's moonlit person than to any wayside object. A little rest for the jaded animal being desirable, he did not hasten his search for landmarks. A clamber over the hill into the adjoining vale brought him to the fence of a highway whose contours he recognized, which settled the question of their whereabouts. D'Urberville thereupon turned back, but by this time the moon had quite gone down, and partly on account of the fog the chase was wrapped in thick darkness, although morning was not far off. He was obliged to advance with outstretched hands, to avoid contact with the boughs, and discovered that to hit the exact spot from which he had started was at first entirely beyond him. Roaming up and down, round and round, he at length heard a slight movement of the horse close at hand, and the sleeve of his overcoat unexpectedly caught his foot. "Tess," said D'Urberville. There was no answer. The obscurity was now so great that he could see absolutely nothing but a pale nebulousness at his feet, which represented the white muslin figure he had left upon the dead leaves. Everything else was blackness alike. D'Urberville stooped, and heard a gentle regular breathing. He knelt and bent lower, till her breath warmed his face, and in a moment his cheek was in contact with hers. She was sleeping soundly, and upon her eyelashes there lingered tears. Darkness and silence ruled everywhere around. Above them rose the primeval yews and oaks of the chase, in which there poised gentle roosting birds in their last nap, and about them stole the hopping rabbits and hares. But, might some say, where was Tessa's guardian angel? Where was the providence of her simple faith? Perhaps, like that other god of whom the ironical Tishbite spoke, he was talking, or he was pursuing, or he was in a journey, or he was sleeping, and not to be awaked. Why, it was that upon this beautiful feminine tissue, sensitive as gossamer, and practically blank as snow as yet, there should have been traced such a coarse pattern as it was doomed to receive. Why, so often the coarse appropriates the finer thus, the wrong man the woman, the wrong woman the man. Many thousand years of analytical philosophy have failed to explain to our sense of order. One may, indeed, admit the possibility of a retribution lurking in the present catastrophe. doubtless some of Tess d'Urberville's male ancestors rollicking home from a fray, had dealt the same measure even more ruthlessly towards peasant girls of their time. But though to visit the sins of the fathers upon the children may be a morality good enough for divinities, it is scorned by average human nature, and it therefore does not mend the matter. As Tess's own people down in those retreats are never tired of saying among each other in their fatalistic way, colon, it was to be. There lay the pity of it. An immeasurable social chasm was to divide our heroine's personality thereafter from that previous self of hers who stepped from her mother's door to try her fortune at Trantridge Poultry Farm. End of phase the first. Phase the second. Maiden no more. Zaya, the basket was heavy, and the bundle was large, but she lugged them along like a person who did not find her a special burden in material things. Occasionally she stopped to rest in a mechanical way by some gator post, and then, giving the baggage another hitch upon her full round arm, went steadily on again. It was a Sunday morning in late October, about 4 months after Tess Derbyfield's arrival at Trantridge, and some few weeks subsequent to the night ride in the chase. The time was not long past daybreak, and the yellow luminosity upon the horizon behind her back lighted the ridge towards which her face was set, the barrier of the veil wherein he had of late been a stranger, which he would have to climb over to reach her birthplace. The ascent was gradual on this side, and the soil and scenery differed much from those within Blackmoor Vale. Even the character and accent of the two peoples had shades of difference, despite the amalgamating effects of a roundabout railway, so that, though less than 20 miles from the place of her sojourn at Trantridge, her native village had seemed a faraway spot. The field folk shut in there traded northward and westward, traveled, courted, and married northward and westward, thought northward and westward. Those on this side mainly directed their energies and attention to the east and south. The incline was the same down which d'Urberville had driven her so wildly on that day in June. Tess went up the remainder of its length without stopping, and on reaching the edge of the escarpment gazed over the familiar green world beyond, now half veiled in mist. It was always beautiful from here. It was terribly beautiful to Tess today, for since her eyes last fell upon it, as he had learned that the serpent hisses where the sweet birds sing, and her views of life had been totally changed for her by the lesson. Verily another girl than the simple one as he had been at home was she who, bowed by thought, stood still here, and turned to look behind her. She could not bear to look forward into the veil. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.